Beneath the streets of London, there is another London, a somewhere that is never where. Benedict Cumberbatch and James McAvoy lead a stellar cast in a BBC radio adaptation of Neil Gaiman's best-selling novel. Start listening to Neverwhere now with a 1 month free trial to Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcherpremium.com/BBC and use promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your free month. You'll also hear the original Flight of the Conchords, love those guys, and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, love that novel, series from the BBC. That's stitcherpremium.com/BBC and use the promo code CRACKED. Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we're the so-called cracked experts on pop culture, I guess. At least films for the last 3 to 4 decades. We're here to point out some things you may or may not know about your favorite classics and drop observations that you might that might ruin the movie for you, or maybe they won't. I don't know. It's up to you, really. For the next hour or so, we'll be dissecting the following film, Memento.
From yeah. Christopher Nolan's breakout film from 2000. Yeah. Continuing Christopher Nolan month. On the podcast.
Yeah. And we'll have 2 more episodes of Nolan, I believe.
Yeah.
After this.
It's a long month.
Long month, 5 weeks. Along with us is our guest, Eric Lampere, who is a comedian, host of the Topical Island podcast, and creator of the Comedian Cinema Club, both on iTunes and SoundCloud. So, Eric, when was the first time that you watched this movie?
I watched it yesterday. I actually didn't remember last time I saw Memento, which I thought was quite funny.
Yeah.
The fact that I didn't even remember. Because I couldn't recall
the
ending.
Right.
Obviously, the ending's at the beginning, but the actual ending of the film, I couldn't remember. So there was a certain joy in rewatching it. But yeah, rewatched it yesterday.
Yeah. I had that experience too, where I had seen it in a limited run when it came out in theaters, because I was lucky enough to live next to like a art house theater. But I didn't realize how long it had been that since I had watched it until I was watching it yesterday to prepare for the podcast. And there were, I remembered the ending, but there were like a lot of details in the middle of the movie that I just completely forgot about. So I had like the same like, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm really enjoying watching films, older films, as an adult now, like the Austin Powers trilogy.
Yeah.
I binged on it last week.
Around the same time too. Yeah.
Because I was a kid back then.
Right.
Like, and I see myself as a kid now, but
we all do.
An older kid.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying going back and going, oh wow. These films I just missed. Like, as a kid, I was like, whoa, it's all backwards. That was just the joy of going, it's not like a usual film.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, Christopher Nolan, I love you.
So, that's what
you created our childhood.
Yes.
So to kick it off, before we begin, Eric, please give us like a, you know, 1 to 2 sentence, if you can, synopsis of the film as you remember it.
It's a man that has a sort of amnesia, short-term memory amnesia, so you can't remember something that happened an hour ago, but anything before the incident he remembers his life, and he tries to essentially work out what happened to him and who he is, and that's it, really, isn't it? Like, he's just trying to work out what happened to him.
There's some murder involved.
Obviously, he wants to find the murderer of his wife.
Exactly.
Or obviously there's a lot of spoilers in this, right?
Yeah.
She even get murdered?
Or did she? Yeah, did she? Didn't she? I think in order to listen to this podcast, you kind of have to have seen it before. If you aren't, do what you want. It's your life. But I mean, like, we are spoiled.
Yeah, and if you're real fans of the film, listen to this podcast. But you start at the end.
Just keep
going backwards.
Yeah, no, just download it and reverse it.
Right.
In a sound
shuffle
editor.
It if we can. We'll break it up into chapters so you can just play it and shuffle.
Yeah. Well, that's a. Let's get a summary. On the show, we like to take some time and do our own, like, reductive or, frankly, awful summaries.
Right.
Join us in this segment that we like to call Terrible Loglines.
A homeless murderer gets a new suit.
Tattoo artist hits a gold mine until man learns to self-tattoo.
That's nice. A bunch of people take advantage of a mentally deranged man, and the police do absolutely nothing to stop it.
One of them is the police. Well, that sort of affects my logline here. A middle-aged cop makes a terrible friend.
I just like that wording.
An unhinged video editor is given film footage and decides to mess with the chronology of the story just before the premiere, forcing the director to accept this as the finished movie.
An amnesiac somehow remembers to keep bleaching his hair.
It's true, it's so very clearly bleached.
Yeah.
All right, now that we know the plot, let's dive into the making of the movie from a pre-production to post-production kind of standpoint in a segment that we call Expensive Pretending.
I love that, expensive pretending. Yeah. That is acting.
It is.
I love
that's,
that.
That's what filmmaking
all it is.
This film was actually quite cheap, wasn't it?
It was $4.5 million,
kind
and then it ballooned to $9 million, but it made $40 million.
Right.
So it's more expensive than you might expect for an independent movie that's more or less, it's basically his first film. Like, Following's his first
film.
This is like his...
But that was like kind of a student film. It was like made on his own budget, 16mm.
Yeah,
like,
and
he
was
just running around.
He was filming it with his friends, and they only were able to film it once a week. I was watching this IFC interview with him. They had to, because they were all working full time, they were only able to film like 15 minutes of footage every Saturday. So it took them like a year to make that movie Following.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so cool, though. I love seeing the birth of Christopher Nolan, because I'm a bit of a nerd and love his... I love it. I love his films. I love his films.
Yeah.
But I love going back and seeing where he comes from. Like, there's a short film I watched about 2 weeks ago called Doodlebug.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen it. It's 2 minutes long, 2.5 minutes long. And it's almost... It's so simple.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like...
I haven't seen that one.
It might be on YouTube, even.
Oh, yeah, wow. It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
And that's a Nolan short?
Nolan short. It's like his third or fourth short. And
and I want to say it's like student film. It's like...
It
feels like student film is the point, but it's just like a little... Yeah, 2 minutes or so, right? It's kind of crazy how, you know, following a... Like, here's a career that we saw when we had already become, like, in our formative years. I don't know. I'm 32. So, like, 17 years ago, I was cognizant enough to know that, like, oh, Lion King had a bunch of people behind it, you know, or just, so I had already started to, like, get involved into, like, okay, so there's a director and there's a guy who's behind the camera and, like, thinking about the, you know, operations. And we've really seen, at least my generation has seen, like, kind of how Nolan came to be.
Definitely, yeah. I remember... Because this movie came out when I graduated from high school. I was going to college when this came out. And for a while, I was trying to go to film school, but it's, as you know, very expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I saw this movie, and I was like, he's going to be the guy.
Tom, tell us about, what do you know about how this movie came to be? Like, the scripting.
It came to be with the brothers Nolan, Christopher and Jonathan.
The brothers Nolan.
We're driving from Chicago to L.A., Christopher was moving here, and along the trip, Jonathan basically pitched him this idea, which was a story he was writing, the story of Memento, and they kind of worked the whole thing out during the drive, and then when they got to the West Coast, Jonathan flew back. He was going to college in D.C. at Georgetown, and they kept working on their own versions of the story at the same time, but they were their own versions. Like, Jonathan was working on his short story version of it, and then Christopher Nolan was writing the screenplay, and they would, like, you know, every so often give each other updates of where they were at with the film.
Is the Jonathan one Memento Moris?
Memento Mori.
Mori.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
And it came out in a Esquire article after the film.
After the film was released, yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, was kind of more...
But didn't he make it before? But then Memento came out, and then Memento Mori came out, and so because Memento came out first, it still counted as the first sort of original script.
Yeah. Basically, yeah.
And people read it because they were like, I like Memento. But I don't know if he finished it before the making of
it.
It wasn't published before the making.
And that's why Eric's exactly right. That's why Nolan was eligible for original screenplay for the Academy Award.
Right.
He didn't win it, though.
He did not.
No. Gosford Park?
I don't know.
That would have been 2000, right? That seems right.
Audience, check us now, and then you'll know something that we don't know in the past. But some stark differences is that it's a lot more linear of a tale, and also takes place in a mental institution.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, the Jonathan Nolan's story is pretty different.
Yeah, but the idea of, like, unreliable narrator and, like, a subjective kind of storytelling narrative is the same.
Right.
Yeah.
But talking of chronology, apparently you can watch Memento in chronological order.
In fact, it's on the DVD.
On the DVD, yeah.
The special edition.
And do you have to, like, do a puzzle?
Hidden or something.
I'm glad you mentioned it, because Nolan actually had to devise a system in order to keep track of it all, because he couldn't just go scene 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So what he did is he used numbers from 1 to 22 for the black and white sequences,
right?
And then letters A to V for the color ones, so that when he could get all of the, he could name them and know exactly what was supposed to happen. So when he was plotting the film, it goes like opening credits, which is, you know, they're shown backward. And then it goes like 1V, 2U, 3T, 4S, all the way down to 22 and A.
And then they meet.
And then it's the credits. So it's kind of this like if you think of it as like a reverse zipper or like two different sides joining together in this, you know, reversal.
What I like about the story of them driving to, you know, La La Land to right. make it big
make
is
it big.
His brother came up with a good idea and he was like, huh, nice.
Yeah, yeah, like, it really is.
Oh, really? Like, what a take dick. That. What a dick move.
Do you mind? Do you mind if I take that?
I'm just going to do this to launch my career. You won't do anything else.
Although, well, right. Jonathan Nolan, isn't he now the big up and coming because of Westworld? Isn't he? Didn't he write?
Yeah, he's producer, yeah. Or I think he wrote the first
Agents
episode.
Of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like he's
I mean, I was being mean to Jonathan when I said that.
And he's also co-written several of the Christopher Nolan films.
Yeah,
yeah, he's done so like five or six, right?
He's been around, but it's definitely true that at least at this point, he's like, oh, that's cool. You got two Academy Award noms, and I might get published in Esquire. That's pretty cool, and it came from my idea.
I find it fascinating. I only realized yesterday when watching Memento how obsessed he is with time. Because you've got Inception that plays with time, you've got Interstellar, right? Interstellar's his.
Yeah.
Yes. Right?
And even in movies not about time, like Prestige, he plays with nonlinear storytelling.
Yeah, right. Like pretty much every single one of Nolan's films that's not a Batman film is about perception and the interior self.
Right.
Because it's all about your subjective reality and what that means when you're trying to reconcile it with what's going on in your exterior. And like this movie is explicitly about that.
Yeah, you said something interesting, which you called it a Mobius strip.
I did not. Nolan said that.
Nolan said called it a Mobius
Nolan
strip.
Refers to the storyline as being a Mobius strip, and a Mobius strip is, if you don't know what it is, it's basically you can make one by taking a piece of paper and kind of twisting it and touching its ends together, but it's a figure that just has one surface and one boundary. So it has one edge and then one surface, so it just means that it just keeps going in a circle. So its end is its beginning,
right?
And that's this movie. Like it ends where it begins.
And in the Inception episode, we talked about M.C. Escher and just the idea of things folding on top of itself.
Yeah,
which is right. Like the next episode, we'll talk about the Tesseract
and actually, you mentioned Escher. One of the reasons why he chose the motel was apparently because it had an Escher feel to it, because it was like. There's like different. It wasn't quite clear in the film. Like, you can't really tell it's a confusing motel, but apparently the motel was very confusing in terms of like how many stairways there were and all the corridors and stuff.
Right.
And
he
was like,
just in
case it has an Escher feel to it.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, in general, he keeps the. In fact, there's one
it's
thing
very close.
He says. When he does the. He calls the color photography subjective. And by that, it's you're always following the protagonist, and he wanted that for those sequences and scripted it such that the way that even when he did the like writing of the story, like the direction of the camera and stuff in the script, he wrote it as if you don't, as you constantly are, he is a part of the audience. Our main character, Lenny, is essentially learning things as we learn them. Yet when you go to the black and white sequences, he calls that objective. And I think what he means by that and the way he filmed it is the camera physically was back farther. It zoomed, not zoomed in, but it was on more telephoto lenses. And what this has the effect of being like a fly on the wall. So you see things a little bit more truly as opposed to the way he approached the camera with the color photography sequences. This was all ingrained in the script. Like this is something that he executed later in production, but really he just wrote it like... This you don't know things when you were in this space. Here you feel like everything's right.
When you write and direct, it's just a lot easier to be able to create a world, right? Because generally, like in a script, you don't say, and this is going to have that shot, and that's going to have this shot. But when you write one that you're going to direct, you can go, and I want this particular shot. So then you know how to write a story with your vision. And I find that writer-directors... Not that they do a better job, but like if you direct a script from someone else's vision, then it's always going
to
be harder.
Right, because you have to interpret that yourself.
And they typically have the confidence to do it.
While you know, with him or let's say Baby Driver, you know, like he wrote it, Edgar Wright that is, knowing what soundtrack he wanted to use. So all of a sudden, like you can, you know, generally like a soundtrack, unless it's very much needed in the script, you don't get a choice of it, especially because of the costs.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And Nolan does that so well because he writes his stuff.
Yeah,
so that's he knows exactly how to.
Exactly.
Yeah. And he wanted a song for this movie that was wound up being too expensive. He wanted to use Paranoid Android for the the Radiohead song for the end credits, but it was too expensive.
That would have taken me out of it too, to be honest.
Well, even the lead actor, apparently, he didn't necessarily want to start with Guy Pearce. I think Guy Pearce was just a cheaper choice.
Yeah, there was a few they went through. There was Brad Pitt was initially cast.
Yeah, he was the first one. Yeah, that they were gonna cast, and then he wound up being unavailable due to a scheduling conflict, and that's when Nolan decided. Sort of, he said he wanted to make the film for less money by using an affordable quality actor.
That is the best, the most like producer statement I've ever heard. Like, we're gonna make it good, we're gonna make it cheap, we're gonna make it fast. You know, it's like all the things that you'd expect. Like, hopeful, wishful thinking.
You know, there's some movies where you can't imagine someone else doing it.
Right.
You know, right? Like, so, like, there's some movies I'm like, oh, no, it has to be, like, George of the Jungle, that has to be Brendan Fraser, right? For example, I don't know why that was my choice there.
Yeah, no,
that's a good one, though.
But that's, like, it has to be him, right?
It has to be him.
And with this film, I feel like any actor could have been replaced. Like,
Elijah Wood is Frodo. You know, like,
it's...
You know what's crazy? Then think about these names. Aaron Eckhart.
Yeah.
Thomas Jane.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Sheen.
Oh.
All considered before Guy Pearce.
Aaron Eckhart, I could see in that role.
Yeah, I don't know why either, but I agree with you.
And obviously he's liked by Nolan because he plays Harvey Dent.
Yeah, and his Batman.
That's true. So shows like a duality of like anger, but also like sensitivity to things.
I'm not sure. I disagree. I mean, I'm not sure. I agree completely with. I think, and it just might be the fact that I really wound up associating Guy Pearce's performance with this movie. I'm not sure he'd be as easily replaceable. I can't articulate.
But like when you said Brad Pitt, I was like, yeah, I could see that. Like,
yeah,
like
probably,
when I
yeah.
think Brad Pitt in Fight Club or 12 Monkeys and that sort of attitude and energy, I'm like, yeah, I could totally see it in Memento.
There was another casting thing that I thought was interesting because they, Carrie Ann Moss, who plays Natalie in this, she told Nolan, you should cast
Joe Pantoliano.
Yeah, specifically because they had already done the Matrix film together.
Yeah,
right.
And he was Cypher, I believe, was his name.
Yeah, yeah. He's the villain in the Matrix. Yeah, the one that's not
believing. Oh, spoiler!
I think the machines might be having a problem.
Perhaps
with that,
man is the real enemy in the Matrix. Yeah, and Nolan didn't want to use him at first because he thought he would be too obviously villainous or too villainous for the role. And they originally wanted Dennis Leary.
Which is very Demolition Man.
Well, or that movie Judgment Night. Have you seen Judgment Night?
I don't think I have, actually.
It's a movie where Emilio Estevez and Jeremy Piven and Stephen Dorff and Cuba Gooding Jr. stranded in a terrible part of town. And Dennis Leary is this crazed drug dealer that's chasing them because they witnessed him murder somebody.
That sounds amazing.
That sounds fun, yeah.
What's it called? Again?
Judgment Night.
Judgment Night.
Judgment Night.
Instead of Judgment Day.
Yeah. Picturing, I don't think, I laughed not because I think Dennis Leary would have been bad in this role. I think he would have been good. I think it would have been a very different performance. And I actually think Dennis Leary would have been more outwardly villainous or like sleazy as this character, whereas Joe Pantoliano kind of
Neutral, right?
Right.
It felt like he could be a good guy or a bad guy.
Right, exactly. Like, and I feel like he wound up pulling off being both. Like, I think he's both in this movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He plays Teddy, by the way,
to be clear. He's like, I had that moment where I was like, he's actually killing it right now because he's kind of like a sleeper because he's always being like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He's always on the defensive at the top of the movie because, I mean, at first he's shot, but then it turns, unravels, it's like him like saying like, I know who you are, trust me, my man. And it's
but he must do that every time.
Yeah.
Because to Guy Pearce, he's a stranger every single time.
Every single time.
If a stranger came up to me and was like, hey, buddy, so anyway, come with me now. You'd be like, what the bloody hell? Like,
yeah. I know about your condition. You don't know me, but I know you.
The scene where he's sitting in his car and he's like, you really should lock your door. I'm like, don't do that to this guy.
Right. Apparently that was improvised.
Oh, I believe that.
Apparently, he didn't know that Joe was going to be in there.
There was quite a bit of improvisation on this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, all of the black and white narration. It's unclear whether it's narration or if it's just what he's saying on the phone to the unknown caller.
Right.
But Nolan encouraged Guy Pearce to just sum up the film, sum up like your condition, just like on this line, just say like, as if you're just telling me, regurgitating my own script back to me, because he wanted that off the cuff kind of like, you know, you get in a car crash or you get your head banged and you're like piecing together sentences as it goes. That kind of feeling of like weightlessness of thought. He wanted to make sure he got that. Why
like
there's
like he's getting his bearings.
Yeah, because there's a few like Guy Pearce at one point, real up top at the movie. He goes like yeah, like he has an unnatural like conversation pause where it's like he's talking to himself. And I think that that's what the purpose of that was, is to make it feel like there's things that are true. Your memory of it is kind of foggy, that kind
of. And feeling. The rhythm of his speech in those scenes works to that way too. Right. Like it'll slow down in those places where it seems like he's searching for something. Then it speeds up when he gets the idea and starts going
right.
with it.
Very effective tool. Yeah. Cause I don't even think Guy Pearce knew that that's what, like he was just a vessel for that kind of feeling. Maybe he did know, you know, I don't know. But point
what,
is, it
what
was
I find interesting is, you know, he is an actor after all.
right.
So obviously you can't have parallel universes where we could just try a different versions. But I'd love to see the version where he was just told, here's the script and do the phone call.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like,
it was
really good in the film, but also you're an actor, so you could easily achieve the pauses in the right places and stuff.
Right. Yeah. 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 Exactly. So good on the team. Speaking of the team.
Yeah. Wally Pfister.
Wally Pfister's back.
Yeah. We've been.
We love him here.
he's a director of photography, and he's done all of his Nolan's films, I guess.
Yeah.
Up until Dunkirk, right?
Dunkirk, yeah. He didn't.
He's so damn good. It struck me watching, because again, I had the same experience where I hadn't watched this movie in a while, so it was like, in some ways, watching with new eyes, and I didn't remember it looking as good as it does.
Right.
I was just, damn, like it's like straight out of the gate. It's like so recognizable as a Nolan film and as, you know, a Wally Pfister film.
And another thing that I think, because I like to check in every episode or two on this Nolan podcast right now, the Roger Deakins Wally Pfister battle that's still going on. 2000 was also the same year that Roger Deakins shot Oh Brother Where Art Thou. So this is like kind of where they're getting close. This is like Nolan's first. This is Pfister's like, here we go. Here's a smaller budget. But like obviously Oh Brother is there. It's the Coen brothers. But this is like put them on the map. To me, this year is the year where the battle between Deakins and Pfister started. I just want to throw that in there.
The Batman v Superman of cinematographers.
Of cinematographers. Yes, definitely.
The composer in this movie, David Julian, is somebody that I wanted to call out because he scored every movie of Nolan's up until the Batman films. That's when Hans Zimmer stepped in, and then Hans Zimmer has scored all of Nolan's films since then. But they both wrote very similar kinds of scores. Like David Julian did Following, Memento, Insomnia, and The Prestige. And we talked about this a little bit on the last episode, but like the kinds of scores that Hans Zimmer does for Nolan movies are, there's no big cues really. It's just kind of like a continuous push of like motion and action and like a simmering kind of feeling. And the score in this movie is very much the same. And so is all the scores that Julian did for Nolan's movies, where it's just this continuous, like, haunting low tone.
Yeah, you can't. Like, if you were to ask yourself right now, like, just sing me a few notes of the Prestige theme or Memento.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, specifically in Memento, yeah, it's, I don't know if you guys can recall the score, but it's just kind of like this low tone that is sad and ominous at the same time.
Mm. I like the word you used here, which is haunting.
Yeah, and I took that to represent sort of Leonard's grief and also drive simultaneously, because he's pushed to revenge, but it's also like he says a couple of times in the film that his wound can't heal because he can't experience time. So it's like he can't advance in his grieving process, which I'll discuss again later.
Yeah, I was going to say,
But then I found David Julian's old website where he has commentary on all the scores that he did, and he talks about this one, and he says that he considers the entire score for this movie to just be Leonard's theme. Like, it's just one song and it's all Leonard's theme. And he says that he was trying to capture, and this is a quote from him, he's trying to capture that feeling where you have a nightmare and wake up and you're scared and you don't know why you're scared, and that's the state Leonard lives in throughout Memento. And I thought that was really...
that's cool.
And that makes sense, because we hear him as a narrator.
Yeah.
So we're actually in his mind, and therefore it makes sense to be
very much so. Yeah.
To be following his his soundtrack rather than the soundtrack around him.
And it's also kind of jumbled up, so like the idea of a start of a song or an end of song not really having much purpose in his mind is kind of a seamless aspect of the film.
Yeah, and definitely what you said where he's a narrator, so we're in his head. This movie's all about subjective reality and the internal self, and it's
lack
all about
of reliability.
That shit.
Let's move on to production, eh? So my favorite new term when I was researching this, it's only a term that is necessary when you separate the idea. It's nonlinear storytelling. When you separate the chronology of the film and the way in which the film is presented, meaning like the chronology of the story versus the the witnessing of the film. And when you the presentation of the film or what witness the idea of the time being jumbled up actually has a dramatic term, and it's called sujet. The sujet. I don't know.
Sujet.
Well, the pronunciation has a Z and an H in it and stuff like that.
Sujet. That's when you're seeing the events not in the order that they actually happened.
That's just the name of the presentation of the film.
Oh, okay.
You call it a fabula is the name of the actual events occurring out of time, or out of time of the film. So the fabula is like what actually happened if you were to put this down
in the
reality,
order that it happened?
In the order that
it
happened.
All right.
The sujet is what you saw. So Memento is a sujet of the fabula of the story of Memento. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like they had to create these terms in order to...
So you watch it in chronological order, that's fabula.
Fabula.
But the way the film is presented is sujet.
Yeah. And as we mentioned it on the DVD.
So would a Pulp Fiction be sujet?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes,
it would.
Because John Travolta's dead. Suddenly he's alive again.
I thought that was interesting in terms of this production because, like, this had been done before. There was, like, La Jetée by Marker. There was, like, Kurosawa did, like, Rashomon. So, like, out of time or nonlinear filmmaking has been around for decades.
So, wait. So, any film with a flashback scene, you could say, is a sujet.
Technically, yeah. But it's more important. I think they've come up with the term when it's, like, the whole leitmotif of the film. Like, it's the idea that it's structured this way in order to inform what you learn, kind of like how Rashomon has like four different narrators.
Right.
When it's more of part of the structure of the film.
But have you guys seen Irreversible?
Yes.
2002?
Long time ago.
I'm glad you mentioned that because this whole idea of doing this and the Memento kind of kickstarted like a 5-year to 6-year thing where right after this came out, like in the beginning of the 2000s, Eternal Sunshine of Spotless Mind, Babel. Amoris Peros, 21 Grams, City of God, Adaptation, Vanilla Sky. Like, we decided as humans that we're like, oh, yes, we need more of whatever this is.
Right.
Another film called Basic.
Basic.
John Travolta, Sam Jackson. Where you see Sam Jackson die like 6 different times because it's a Rashomon thing where they're
right. Yeah. Judgment Night and Basic.
That's my two contributions.
I just thought it was interesting that it like the production did not have the faith. They did not know that this thing was going to work out, that audiences would accept this.
Oh, yeah.
And they all went along with it anyway.
Yeah, that was actually they couldn't get American distribution. Mm-hmm. Because of that reason. Like, they showed it to, like, Miramax and like, everyone pretty much, and they all were like, this is a good movie. We don't think people are going to... We think it's going to be too complicated for people.
Yeah, in fact, give credit to Steven Soderbergh, because after everyone was like, this is a great script, but we're going to pass because we think the audiences aren't going to like it, Soderbergh publicly, like, in interviews and public events, talked about, like, this is the shit right here. Like, check this out. And then that only after he had done that did New Market buy it for distribution.
Right. I do love Hollywood sometimes. Like, right. They just don't have the finger on the pulse of the nation because, like, they go, oh, no, Memento is quite confusing. Anyway, let's do emoji films.
Yeah, well.
I mean, come on.
Different time.
Come on. I know it's a different time, right. But still, like, as soon as that came up to the table, someone could have gone, maybe let's not make this film.
That's also a Sony problem specifically. Like, Sony's been very bad at making movies the past couple of years, and they're responsible for that goddamn emoji movie.
Let's cut to an advertisement for Sony.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Shit, probably should say that. They shot this in 25 days in Los Angeles.
Which is fast.
Super fast.
Like, super fast.
Yeah. That's an emoji.
Most, like, and I don't know the average because every film's different, but, like, for people who don't know, like, 60 is, like, a reasonable request by, you know, a production to make a film.
Yeah, and It doesn't have any establishing shots, which is...
Yeah.
It doesn't have many, like all the houses that he goes into, you don't already really know where you are. Like, it's just a house that could be anywhere in the world.
That's super deliberate.
Yeah, it is super deliberate.
Because he never knows where he is.
Yeah.
So right. we're never given a frame of reference for any place. We never see Natalie's house. We just see, like, he's already inside it, and we see, like, one side of it as he gets into his car. We never see the place that he goes to kill the
people. I think the widest it gets is that sequence with him and Teddy where they're going back and forth between, like, the three cars, and he throws the keys.
Right.
Because that, like, whips over, and it, even though it's not a wide lens, you get a good field of view of it. Mm-hmm. But even that is up against a wall. And it just looks like industrial buildings.
Yeah.
So, like, intentionally, even when it is wide, I think Nolan was very specific in making sure that we don't get a lot of bearings.
Yeah, the movie has no... There's no geography to the movie.
Exactly.
We never know where we are in relation to anything else.
Yeah.
Which has to be deliberate.
Super deliberate.
And also, we mentioned last episode for Inception that he had three distinct visual sort of motifs for every layer of the dream.
The rain, the night interior, and the snow.
Right. So that no matter, even though he cuts a lot between them, the audience would know immediately where they were. And he does that in this movie with the black and white and the color. So he cuts back and forth. I think I read it's something like 113 timeline jumps in this
that
movie.
Is... Crazy.
But the viewer's never confused because he has that very clear, the black and white stuff and then the color stuff. So we always know where we are.
Yeah.
But you're not confused if you pay attention.
Yeah.
So unlike other films with Nolan, you kind of do have to pay attention. You can't just go quickly get a drink from the fridge and then come back.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because then you're like, what did I just miss there?
It definitely demands your attention, which is,
right.
I think Nolan's like... It's a trick that he does, and it's something that in screenwriting, I want to say John Landis, but probably predates him, something he quotes is, "Meanwhile, back at the ranch." Are you familiar with this?
Mm-mm.
What it means is it's a very basic story structure where it's just like you only talk about – you get out of the scene when it starts being boring or it stops being interesting. Then you need a B plot so that you can go
to
something else. So in other words, every scene ends with, imagine there's two ranches, and every scene ends with, meanwhile, back at the other ranch. And then after that scene's done, meanwhile, back at this other ranch.
Sure.
And he does that with this using the flashback, I guess,
the two halves of the timeline.
Yeah, exactly. And so it makes for scenes that can exist, like the Natalie Leonard scene where he's in her house. That's like a longish scene for him. For Nolan, it runs around like 3 to 4 minutes, which is like an eternity for Nolan. Because Nolan sometimes does, if you remember in our Prestige episode, we talked about how some of the segments are just like, the only scene that we're really seeing is like he's doing a magic trick for the child. Christian Bale is like doing a little bit just to show that like he and the
right.
kid get it.
Yeah.
You know, and then it jumps to something else. And now we're, you know.
Yeah, you pointed out a statistic that was something like in The Prestige, there's a timeline jump like every 90 seconds,
yeah,
something like that.
On average. And it's
in
just
the Prestige.
Like, yeah. And here in Memento, as his first like major Hollywood film, he's already penning his like artistic style, which is I'm going to weave in a way that like constantly you're on your toes, you know,
right.
And I think that's what you're speaking to.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Weirdly, it's a completely linear film, meaning that you cannot remove a single scene because every scene begins with the end of a previous scene and ends with the beginning of the next scene.
Mm. Right.
So if you laid the film out in chronological order, you couldn't remove a single scene or else it just wouldn't work.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting because I can't think of very many other movies that are totally linear. The only one I thought of immediately off the top of my head was Rope.
Yeah, you're right about that. Because it's like contingent that you see just the last line. Like there's one, remember the sequence where he's in the bar where the scene starts with him drinking and that drunk on
it
the
starts
side
laughing,
goes like,
yeah, yeah.
And you see him and you're like, what's that all about?
There.
You know, cut to in, you know, 8 minutes where you see what predates that scene. The last shot is still on Guy Pearce, but you hear in the audio the guy's laugh before we cut to the next sequence. You know, because Nolan knew. All they need to know is that, like, lecherous laughter. It doesn't need it. Like, he doesn't need a shot. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
We just got this a few movies like that. I mean, Irreversible, again, mentioning that one. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah, that's the one with Monica Bellucci, right?
I want to say, yeah.
Oh, I'm not very good with names. It is. But it's a super hardcore French film.
Yes, yeah.
It's like, you know, that tunnel scene is like, one of the famous things it's for. I mean, anyone that's seen the film will be like, oh, yeah, tunnel scene, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone that hasn't, go see the film.
It's one of those films where it's like you only need to see it once. And then you never really need to rewatch.
You never
it.
Want to see it again. Although I kind of do want to because of how it was created.
How it was created, like it is more interesting than like a Requiem for a Dream. But that's in the same category for me. Like I remember when my friend bought me a DVD because we had talked at length about Requiem for a Dream after we saw it in theaters, and then he bought me the DVD, and I still to this day have it, and it's still in its wrapping. Yeah, because I'm just like, that was a good movie. Not going to put that on. There's never been a time where I'm like, what should I do?
Yeah. When we eventually do Aronofsky on this podcast, that's going to be the first time I have rewatched any of his films. Because all of his films are like that to me. I'm like, that's an excellent movie. I never need to see it again.
You're absolutely right about that. You're absolutely right. Let's talk about post-production. I thought there was a few really interesting things. For example, the marketing was like, I remember I was reading this on, I think there's a Nolan Wikipedia, and I was reading it. Jonathan Nolan, once again, as we're going back to this, like, oh, I got an Esquire. Oh, I got Academy Award nominations. Jonathan Nolan designed the film's official website. So that's an interesting thing. Granted, it's 2000, so I'm sure a lot of creative people were just like, what's this new form of media?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? But they got the idea of, they did a few things that were really bizarre. It's like one of the first like proto-viral campaigns that we saw. Like I'm sure you all remember like Cloverfield and how they had a website and they invented like a slusho and stuff like that. Like we have developed since then to become a, you know, kind of a different beast in like the viral marketing idea. But this was, and this wasn't the first time it had happened.
No, it's Blair Witch.
Blair Witch,
before.
Exactly. But they got the idea. So they had a website that like dropped off clues and like showed you images, and like you could never like gather solvency for the film, but you'd be able to gather a mystery.
Yeah, it was like a snapshot of Leonard's life, right? It was a bunch of his Polaroids and like some of his maps and like pieces of his investigation. And they did it's funny, they did the same thing later that year with Donnie Darko.
Right.
Donnie Darko had a website, but it didn't tell you anything about the movie. It was like his various case files from him being in institutions and stuff like that. And it was something we were very fascinated with in the early 2000s.
They also sent Polaroids to just random people. Like the one, the bloody photo of him
pointing
at like,
chest,
when he apparently first killed John Q, where he was like clearly they're hinting at, he's pointing at, this is the space where I'm going to write, like, you took care of business.
That was a lobby card, too. I remember seeing that in lobbies where it would just be that photo with no explanation, just standing on like the concession stand.
Hey, there's a brand new show here at Earwolf. It's called Homophilia, and you should subscribe to it now. Homophilia is a show where Dave Holmes and Matt McConkie meet with fantastic LGBT celebrities and grill them about what they're loving, their favorite movie, TV, music, and who they're loving, whether it's a, you know, like a Grindr thing or a long-term partner or whatever. I don't know. If you heard Matt's miniseries Rock Bottom on Bitch Sesh, it's a lot like that. Matt's a writer for bajillion dollar properties and also the official film critic of Bitch Sesh. And he's teamed up with a writer, TV host, and former MTV VJ, remember that, Dave Holmes, to make Homophilia. Their first guest is the wonderful and hilarious Cameron Esposito. And episodes come out on Fridays, so subscribe to Homophilia on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And if you like it, tell a friend, hey. So that's how the movie was made. So let's get into some observations.
Yeah, man.
A segment we like to call
Hidden Bullshit.
Secret Things.
Oh, man.
It's basically
this is my favorite segment.
Where we talk about symbolism you may or may not have noticed.
One thing that I noticed was repeated imagery of needles, which foreshadows the reality that Sammy is actually Leonard, because it keeps showing in the black and white scenes where he's giving himself a tattoo, he's doing this complicated process,
right?
And he mentions the idea of learning through repetition, like complicated tasks that he can remember as long as he did them before the accident, or like Leonard is insisting, I can learn to do new things, it's just a matter of repetition,
right?
So he's doing this complicated task over and over again, and it involves him, you know, heating up the ink and like making this needle, and that's of course related to what we see with Sammy, where he remembers to do this complicated task involving a needle, which is giving his wife the insulin shot.
Yeah. I thought that I didn't pick that one up. I actually picked up a different one, but between Sammy and Leonard, I love that the psychological litmus test that like Sammy goes to with like the metal shapes where he gets buzzed mm-hmm. and electrocutes and then flips off the, you know, the guy. Mm-hmm. It's like a pain-based test. And I thought that it's not just a similarity of like psychology and repetition and how their brains are similar, but also that there's also they have to go through pain and grief in order to figure it out.
One thing that you might find interesting, but I don't know if it has any relation to the film, but maybe it has. There was this amazing experiment done on flatworms where someone would flash a light at the flatworm and then electrocute it. And after a while, like Pavlovian sort of theory, you know, right. After a while, they knew that the flash of light would mean an electrocution, so the flatworm would roll into a ball, naturally, mm-hmm. before the electrocution. Mm. He then cut the flatworm in half. The brain grew a tail, the tail grew a brain, right, which is what flatworms can do. And they flashed a light, and both did it. So not only did the brain with a new tail, but the tail with a new brain knew that the flash of light meant that.
A correlation between DNA and instinct.
It means that you can have muscle memory,
right.
even if your brain doesn't necessarily know it.
That's
right?
Fascinating.
Like people that play piano, they've done it their whole life. Mm. That now they can just play the piano, and apparently the brain bit is just... It's a totally different bit of the brain. They just sort of don't even need to use their brain.
Yeah.
And then the same thing with the flatworm, even weirder. They taught a new flatworm the same thing, right? Electrocute it. They then mashed it up into just tiny pieces and fed it to a flatworm. They're cannibalistic. Fed it to a flatworm that didn't have that knowledge of light and electrocution.
You better not say what you're about to say.
And well, after digestion, the flatworm learned that the light meant electrocution, which means that there is muscle memory to a certain extent. I don't know too much about it, but so when I watched that scene, it kind of bothered me a little bit because I felt like, okay, if his memory is affected and that's his brain, I feel like his body would learn that the action from one to the other. His body would learn that, I think. But that, don't quote me. I mean, I'm not.
No, it's a good point.
You're a scientist, but
I think you're correct because I was reading that what we see Sammy do in the movie is based on a real test that they did to somebody who had this specific type of amnesia, and it was pretty much the same test. The doctor would shake the guy's hand, but shock him with a joy buzzer each time.
Right.
And the guy did eventually learn to stop shaking his hand. He didn't understand why, but he just knew he wasn't supposed to.
Right.
So I think having Sammy never learn it in the movie was a probably deliberate choice because it's part of Guy Pearce denying that Sammy's story is actually his story.
Right.
Like he wants to say, well, I was able to learn through repetition, whereas this guy wasn't. And he wound up, you know, poisoning his wife with insulin, even though Leonard's the guy who poisoned his wife with insulin.
Right.
So that.
Well, we don't know.
But how does he remember that? Right. That's the thing. If he's got short term memory, how does he remember anything that's happened afterwards?
The repetition.
But he wouldn't remember.
You have to assume. Because, how does he even know that there was an investigation? How does he even know that he has this
I don't even know if I believe Teddy. Like, Teddy, when he finally reveals, like, oh, you know, but you did kill him and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I'm like, who are you?
Yeah.
I don't even know if your name's Teddy.
There's a few random, like, you wouldn't have noticed it. I noticed only one of them, but the rest I actually got off, like, trivia websites about it. But there's some fascinating stuff that is clearly deliberate that looks like a mistake inside the movie. One thing is that, you know how Lenny has two different rooms because Bert is making, you know, skimming some off
the
top.
Right, he's renting him two rooms.
Renting him two rooms. The two rooms are 304, and the one that he comes out of initially is 21. So if you notice, that's 0 through 4, but jumbled up. And I feel like the two rooms that he lives in have a clear sequence of narrative, but it's all jumbled
it's mixed up.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah,
that's cool.
There's more of that kind of stuff. When he's writing down Teddy's license plate number, the number is SG137IU. But when Leonard writes it down, it cuts to 71U, which is what he gets tattooed onto his leg. However, at the beginning of the movie, Natalie sends Leonard a package about Teddy, and the number is 7IU. Which is the correct number. Leonard checks with his number on his leg and looks at it and just doesn't notice. And as the audience, you know what's happening because you've already seen the scenes. You just run along with it, but it's a very clear, one's an I, one's a one.
Right.
And I think that that's another nod of Nolan going, like, his brain is just, like, unreliable. And one last one is that when he's fleeing Dodd, That's the guy he's in the chase with, who's the drug dealer.
Which is a great scene.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
I'm chasing
this guy.
No, he's chasing me. Yeah, it's so fantastic. Leonard is reading the description that Natalie wrote down for him. You see him thinking what she's written down, and he says that Dodd is staying at the Mount Creston, yet it's written as Montreston. So it's like there's clear just like he doesn't, for some reason, he's just not getting all of the details exactly correct.
Which is why I don't believe that I don't believe that he has amnesia.
I don't think you can believe anything Leonard says by the end.
Right.
Yeah. I just don't believe he has it, because there's so many weird things. Like, he says that he loves his wife, even though all the flashbacks, his wife looking absolutely miserable. Right. Like, you could have had any flashbacks, right? Because if you've got a flashback of a whole marriage, you could use excerpts of when they're happy. But Christopher Nolan chose at times when she just looked really unhappy.
The only full scene we get is when he's picking on her for no reason about reading a book that she likes to read.
Yeah, what a dick.
The rest of the time, it's just like little images. But that's like, yeah, you're right. That's the only scene we get.
So they haven't got a happy marriage. Then also you're told that he's... an insurance
investigator.
Investigator,
that's
right?
What he says, yeah.
But how many insurance investigators are really good at like fighting and using guns? And I know that in America you might you go to gun ranges, and maybe the average American might know more about guns. But he seemed quite good at handling that sort of stuff. And I'm like, you're just an insurance guy.
It's
like,
true.
And I know that he has that passion to get the guy that raped and killed his wife, but he didn't love his wife that much, because the last thing he remembers is his wife, right? Therefore, still happy marriage. Isn't there a scene at one moment where he has sex with a prostitute?
No, he doesn't sleep with her. He says, we're just going to fall asleep, and then I want you to get up and slam the bathroom
door.
Yeah,
you know, there's that one. But isn't there another scene where he is... You don't see the sex.
No, there's no sex. They're laying in bed with each other as if it seems like it's like a post-coitus kind of thing, but it's not. She's just waiting for him to fall asleep so that she can go to the door and wake him up by loudly closing the door.
Right.
Because that's his last memory, is he goes to grab the pillow and it's cold, and he's like, oh, but in this case, I guess it would be warm. But as he describes his last moments of like remembering her, is like remnants of her. It's like waking up and looking and seeing her stuff on the bedside table, and then... it all is cut off by the second that he opens the door, and that's the reality kick in of, like, when he looks at it, she's doing cocaine, and she's like, do you want some? But in his memory, right up to that point is when he opens the door and he sees his wife being raped and murdered.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Eric's point, what you just said, goes perfectly into the next bit that I had written, which is, and I didn't realize it before, but you point out they don't have a happy marriage. He probably doesn't really love his wife that much. And it made me realize that his whole argument for when he tells the Sammy Jenkins story was that he turned him down because he thought his affliction was mental and not physical. It was a mental problem he was having. I think maybe that's the answer to Leonard's amnesia, is that it's a mental disorder he has, because he's clearly remembering things selectively, because he does have some new memories after the incident.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, he knows the investigation. Yeah, we see he has the file, but he knows he has the file. Yeah.
But also, he knows that he has a condition.
Yes.
The amount of times he mentions to someone, oh, by the way, I have this condition.
Yeah.
But if you had this condition, you would remember
it.
That
yeah.
you had this condition.
Right.
So, in fact, I don't believe that he has that.
There's another film, it's actually a comedy starring Dana Carvey that actually...
Clean Slate.
That is more religious to the idea of, he wakes up and he doesn't even know that he has this problem, this amnesia.
Right.
And so he has to like relearn it every day, kind of like a Groundhog-esque
right.
kind of reliving.
But yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
it's like
dive in.
A whole thing that I wrote. But like I said, most other Nolan movies, this movie's about perception versus reality, trying to integrate your interior self with your exterior, or rather how you choose to do so. And at one point, Leonard asks the question, does the world stop existing when you close your eyes? Which is sort of meant to be rhetorical, because he's using it as a point. Like, he's like, well, no, I can't. I have to keep moving, because the world doesn't stop just because I don't understand it. But for him, it's true. Like, the world does not exist for him when he closes his eyes, you know, quote unquote, because he can't experience time. He never knows where he is. And his memory is so selective that bit by bit, he has constructed the world for himself. So the real world does not exist to him. He has only... Even if he was like experiencing this disease or this disorder in its straightforward form, where he just physically is unable to produce new memories, he only has his interior self anymore. That's all he has. Like you mentioned at the top of the podcast, we're inside his head because that's all he has. Like he doesn't have the exterior anymore.
Mm. One thing I found weird, I don't know about you guys, very unlikable. I walked
toward the end
from the film going, ah.
He's the villain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like,
it's every character gets flipped. So we start the movie, we're on Leonard's side because we're in his shoes. We don't know what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's our surrogate, basically. We trust Natalie because she's nice to him. We don't trust Teddy because all we know is that he supposedly is the guy that did this to him, and he just has his on the back of his Polaroid, don't trust his lies, the entire movie. But as the movie progresses, we learn that Natalie's is not so, I mean, I sympathize.
She's not a good, I mean, she's not a good person.
She's not a good person. Yeah. I'm not necessarily mad at her because Leonard shows up in her boyfriend's clothes and car after killing him.
Yeah. Like, but she does manipulate him once she learns his condition.
Every character does.
Yeah.
The character that manipulates Leonard the most is Leonard, though.
Yeah.
Like, ooh. You know? Like,
yeah.
But and then, you know, Teddy, obviously, towards the end of the film, we're kind of more sympathetic with Teddy because it's like he started out, if we're taking him at his word,
right.
He was the cop that came to Leonard's house to respond to this and was like, I feel sorry for this guy. I want to help him get his revenge. Mm-hmm. And then he took that Polaroid.
He's also a bad cop, though.
He is, yeah, because he's using Leonard.
Yeah.
He's aiming Leonard at people to, like,
getting a bit of money.
Yeah, getting a little bit of money, getting, you know, quote-unquote. He's doing, like, some vigilante work with Leonard.
Yeah,
he's like,
yeah.
Well, that guy's a dirtbag. Let's get him out of the way and make some money. What's the harm?
Right.
So he's not a great guy either, but he becomes way more sympathetic at the end of the film.
How long have they been doing this, though?
It's unclear.
Because, like, where are the cops trying to stop him? Because I know that Teddy's a cop as well, but other people will be like, there's been some murders in the same area for a while.
It's definitely intentionally, like, they
intentionally
have an
vague.
Yeah.
If we believe Teddy, he says it's been about a year.
Jesus, how many people?
And also several cities, several towns.
Yeah.
Like, they've moved
he
around.
He just needs a new John.
Yeah, he needs a new John G.
But, you know, like at the end, he chooses to just... Because the film is also about purpose. Like, having a purpose in life is more important than just wandering,
exactly,
doing nothing, right? And I sort of sympathized with that. I was like, yeah, yeah. And his purpose is just to revenge, even though he's already had his revenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every character manipulates Leonard. Teddy does, obviously, like we just said. Yeah. Natalie does, like we just said, because she wants to get rid of the guy that's coming after her for Jimmy's money. Even the hotel clerk, every named character. So the hotel clerk, Bert, manipulates him by renting him two rooms. But Leonard does the most harm to himself. If we believe Teddy, he has removed the information from the police investigative file himself to create a mystery. He creates a false story about Sammy to separate himself from what actually happened with his wife, so to remove himself from the guilt of what happened. He doesn't remember that it's more important to him that she was murdered than that she survived. And we're shown this.
He also burns the photos.
He burns
after
the photos.
He kills Jimmy G.
Yeah. And the photo of him pointing at his chest.
Mm-hmm.
But it also suggests, like, that the frailty of memory. Do you guys have memories where you thought...
You sort of
recreate something and then turns out it wasn't a memory at all.
And in the reverse direction, something that was super traumatic dawns on me only later that I'm like, oh, man, I super suppressed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it goes both ways, I think, because we have to get up and live the next day.
We see flashes of that.
Right.
Like, we see an image early on of his wife lying in bed next to him and looking at him. And then later we see that image that it's actually her laying on the bathroom floor with
right.
the shower curtain taken
And the same
off
thing
her,
with the pinch.
With the pinch,
the
and then it becomes the needle.
Incident.
We see him for a split second sitting in Sammy's seat in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also see at the very end of the movie him lying in bed with his wife with I've Done It tattooed in that empty spot on his chest.
Right.
Which...
should wrap up the topic.
It's not conclusive, but it means maybe he did get revenge while she was still alive.
Right.
He just didn't get the tattoo because he didn't remember
or
chose not to remember.
And he's killed a bunch. Because I think that that's probably the most like scholarly understanding of the film, and I'm sure a lot of our audience has gotten that. I want to double down and find there's an even more sinister version of this that image of the I've done it kind of thing might throw a wrench in the gears, but like here's the thing is that I really want to talk about the book that his wife is reading and then he later burns it. It's a book without a title. The cover is ripped off and it just says chapter one, and they have a dialogue that is super interesting to me that makes, like, I just want to read. This is an actual scene. The lines with his wife while he's reading the book. He starts, "How can you read that again?" She says, "It's good." "Yeah, but you've read it like 1,000 times. I enjoy it. I've always thought the pleasure of a book was in wanting to know what happens next." And then it cuts out of the flashback, and Lenny's first line is, "Probably done this before." And to me, that's in tune with, like, this interpretation of this movie. But what if he's doing this intentionally? In other words, that he, in the moment that he realized he killed the first John...
It's the end of his book.
He realized that he would forget, though.
Right.
And so he is actively and just replaying this kind of, like... Kind of like Groundhog Day, like he has to just reset.
Restart the book, yeah, restart
like,
the book.
Yeah. Yeah, just reread it because he enjoys the thrill of getting a piece of her back by murdering a guy. So it could be not only that his disease, or I mean, not his disease, but his disorder is in charge of him, but he is also manipulating, as you said, his own disorder to replay the same book over and over and over because he enjoys it.
Yeah, I did wonder if this was actually a sort of undercover serial killer movie.
Right.
Because, you need to kill, what, 2 or 3 before being a serial killer, and they have to have a sort of a degree of time in between them. And, and you know, you get like trophies, and maybe his trophies are tattoos. So I was like, oh, maybe he's like a serial killer. Actually.
Oh yeah, maybe each fact is something he added after he killed somebody,
right?
To make it that person,
right?
Because that we see him do that to Teddy.
Yeah, he writes down. Well, I'm gonna. Your license number is now on the list.
And I quite like that. He finds his victims, then he forgets about them, and he has to hunt them. And then when he finally kills them, he generally just sort of adds a tattoo or something. And I quite like that. Because, like, you know, fact 5 was the license plate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fact 6, add a fact 6 and cross out fact 5. Or, you know, like, he could just keep hunting and essentially be a serial killer.
Yeah, each time he kills somebody, he adds a fact that puts him on to the next person.
Right.
You know what? So we watched the movie. We talked about observations. Right now, we want to go to a segment where we talk about any weird, non-intuitive arguments about the movie. We call the segment "Let's Overthink It."
I like that. Like, unlike what we've been doing so far,
it's kind of more of this. But now we're like going to dive
now,
in.
Now we're getting into like where we're picking the movie apart.
Yeah,
which is what we just kind of started doing.
I did enjoy watching this film, knowing we now have iPhones.
Right.
Because, like, he could just take loads of pictures.
Put it on the cloud.
Yeah, videos.
quick voice memos to himself.
Yeah, like, those existed at the time. Voice memos. Like, he could have a tape recorder.
He could have a tape recorder, yeah, that's true.
I mean, that's what Clean Slate did. But he chooses not to. He chooses tattoos as his main
Polaroids,
forms.
Yeah.
Interesting methods.
Well, tattoos make sense. Like, I make notes on my hand.
That's
pretty,
yeah. You don't have to carry, you literally
carry it with you. The tattoo actually is...
And I think with the tattoo thing, it makes sense that he chooses to become a killer again. Because imagine living a life now where you've got a massive tattoo of, like, this guy killed and raped
my
wife.
Murdered my wife, like, right across his chest.
It's like, well, you need a sense of purpose now. You can't just be like, well, that's done.
My favorite tattoo of his, which, by the way, you can tell when he did it versus when a professional did it, because, you know, just the penmanship is good or not. There's one, it's in the first shot where he's, like, putting a shirt on for the first day, I want to say. Or the last day, because it's in the color sequence. But there is a, right at the top of his pelvis, like right where his belt meets, there's just, it's just a single word. It just says, "Eat."
Yep. I saw that.
I thought that was the most hilarious, like, thing to tattoo yourself. Also, remember that scene, like, there would have to be a scene where he walks in, he's like, just put "eat" right there.
But again, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's obviously it's comical.
Yeah.
But, like, He knew how to eat before the incident.
Yeah.
I think the issue is remembering the last time he ate. I mean, I guess he would feel hungry.
His stomach, right?
Yeah, he would feel hungry. That's true.
His stomach helps.
I feel like that would be a danger to him, remembering to eat and stay hydrated.
It's like saying, well, you must all then put piss and blink.
That's true. That's true. His body would let him know that he was hungry or thirsty. That's definitely true.
Yeah.
When he's getting chased by Dodd, and he circles back around and jumps back into his Jaguar. How does he know that's his car?
Could you say that it was just opportunity? He saw a car and took it?
Maybe.
It could be. He does beeline for it. I mean, it is the coolest car, but he assumes that he has the keys to it, which I don't know. Yeah, maybe, I mean, maybe right when we cut away from him, he looks at the keys and it says Jaguar on them. Like, there's ways in which you can always solve it in a Nolan film.
And
but
how's he getting money?
He
has all this cash.
But like, I wondered like, if like there was a, because if he's an insurance salesman,
he says,
right,
he's stocked up on life insurance.
Right. He's, my guess is that his wife, when she died, he got life insurance from her. But then if he would killed have been... her,
no, there's a line where he says that actually.
But then if he killed her, he wouldn't cash in.
Well, it would have been an accidental.
Yeah, he
death.
Didn't get blamed for the death.
Oh,
I'm
he
sure,
didn't.
I'm sure not. No. Like, or else he'd be in an institution or something. Right. Like, yeah. I mean, it's.
Well, he said they found the. They thought they'd found the killer.
Well, if I'm coming from the supposition that he actually overdosed her on insulin,
he's got this condition already, though.
Yeah, and I don't think they would find him at fault for that.
No, you know what insurances are like. The fact that literally the whole thing is, can Sammy's wife have like the money and help required to help?
That's
Sammy.
True. Yeah.
And he's like, no, because of this weird thing. And you think that somehow the same insurance company is going to be like, yeah, you murdered her, but by accident, so it's fine. Like, no, they'll find a way to go.
Here's your money.
You can't get any money.
But it's pretty true that with that observation, if we are to believe what Teddy's saying, and he is Sammy, why isn't he like Sammy in an institution?
Maybe he broke out.
Maybe he broke out and started tattooing himself.
Maybe Teddy had him released to like him. He's like, well, I'll take care of him.
Yeah.
Because we know Teddy's aiming him at people.
Where it's
following... that's how. That must be how. I'm sorry.
No worries.
I didn't interrupt you. But, you know, when in the very last scene when Teddy tells him, half of it's going to be yours. So maybe they have. Maybe this isn't the first time he's gotten money out of it. He's just been giving Leonard the other half of the money.
Yeah,
no, he wouldn't give him half, though, would he?
He would give him a little bit to live.
Yeah, he'd give him enough to live.
He doesn't need to give him any.
I was gonna say I'd love to see the film actually just following Teddy. Because,
yeah,
because actually he must be like a carer. Just every hour he's I'm gonna go check on Lenny again.
Because every time
he's constantly there, going,
every time, every time Leonard contacts him, he shows up immediately. Like, he keeps
no wife,
close.
No kids, no job. How is he doing other detective work?
Well, I actually already made that movie. It's a book. It's a Steinbeck. It's Of Mice and Men, where a man takes control of a mentally challenged man named Lenny. So we're done here. But we want to talk about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter and Instagram at @CrackedMoviePod. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/CrackedMoviePod or just search Cracked Movie Club. Please hit us up with your thoughts. We've been Abe.
And Tom.
And Eric. Eric, where can we find you online?
Just the typical social medias. And like you mentioned, I've got a podcast called Topical Island.
We've been honored that you've joined us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Me. Apologies, I'm no expert on Christopher Nolan.
Oh, no.
You're amazing. Yeah. And you brought that flatworm thing. Knocked it out of the park.
Crushing it.
Next week, we'll be talking about another Nolan, Interstellar. And we're hoping to have returning guest Alex Schmidt join us. And comment, people. We're open to films and directors that you think that we should talk about, so let us know. And we seriously read and listen to your guys' thoughts. That's it.
Yep.
Watch on, movie people.
Oh, hey, everybody, I'm Dave Holmes.
And I'm Matt McConkie, the sidekick that Dave Holmes never wanted.
You're not a sidekick. You are a full co-host.
Oh, please. I should be so lucky to have that title.
Come on. We are on an equal footing here. And homophilia.
Homophilia.
It's all about us, me and Matt, talking to a wide variety of LGBTQI+ individuals about their lives, about their pop culture diets, what they're watching on TV, what they're loving, and
who they're loving.
Who
so
they're
loving. We're going to take a deep dive into their personal lives, ask some very intrusive questions, you know, about what their current dating status is, how did they come out, what was their biggest heartbreak, what's going on in their Grindr account, can we see their Grindr account?
Can we improve their Grindr account?
Oh, yeah.
We'll be releasing new episodes every Friday.
Homophilia is coming to you beginning Friday, August 11th, right here on Earwolf.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.